This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and concepts the better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text or a concept we hope will shed light on the world around you. And this week, it's utilitarianism, isn't it?
Well, I figured why not discuss this? Because ultimately, I think once I explain it, a lot of people may be able to relate to it, although not without some concerns, because it's one of the appeals that it has is that it's very commonsensical.
Okay, and of course, you know, there are famous people associated with this theory, and who would they be?
Jeremy Bentham is one of them. He's a well-known historical figure. He was a philosopher, activist, academic. He campaigned for abolition. This was late 18th century.
And British.
And British, correct. The rights of women. He was also an early advocate of animal rights. And it's actually, his advocacy for animal rights actually ties into utilitarianism in a lot of ways. So we can discuss that too. And of course, the more famous figure is John Stuart Mill, who was also progressive for his time. He was Bentham's student. And he wrote the famous treatise on utilitarianism called Utilitarianism, and also The Subjection of Women, which was one of the early key canonical texts of Western feminism.
So is their philosophy or that theory of utilitarianism linked to the kind of political and social positions they took, or positions they took on social and political issues?
Yes, there is a clear link. They never hit that connection. So for them, utilitarianism was this brave new way of thinking about ethics. So perhaps that's a good segue for me to kind of introduce their basic principles. Essentially, the utilitarian assumption is that actions are right or wrong solely based on their consequences. On top of that, they also claim that the only thing that matters is the amount of happiness or unhappiness that an action yields. And on top of that, they also believe that each person's right to happiness is the same. That means each person's entitlement to happiness should be the same. So already you see that it's very majoritarian, and it's also egalitarian in the sense that our actions should take into account other people's happiness, unhappiness, to the greatest extent possible.
So these, in some ways, were these ideas responding to currents, political currents, the French Revolution, the rising tide of democracy, mm-hmm. or the dismantling of feudal orders around Europe?
Mm-hmm. This was one of the interesting breakthrough ethical theories, and that it doesn't appeal to any higher metaphysical order to justify its actions.
So it's deeply secular and atheistic even?
Not necessarily. It doesn't have to be. But it definitely was an alternative in its time against the more, I guess, religious, biblical, mythological, and more metaphysical kinds of ethics that had dominated Europe up to that point. They're not antagonistic to religion per se. In fact, if religion can be argued to yield the greatest amount of happiness for the greatest amount of people, then it would fall squarely along with utilitarian principles. But the idea is that everybody deserves happiness and that our actions should be motivated towards realizing that goal. So already, just based on the three precepts that I listed, we can notice some of its key characteristics. The first is that it's consequentialist. So the worth of any action is to be measured solely by its outcomes, right? And this is contrasted with, say, for example, the human rights approach, where any action is not dependent on the outcome, right? I can make a statement about Islam or Malaysia that will offend everybody, and it would not be wrong based on the rights framework, because the rights framework would say you are entitled to your opinion, you're entitled to express it, right? Contrast this with the utilitarian perspective, where consequences matter, right? In that case, an action cannot be of intrinsic worth for its own sake, because its value is dependent on what happens after the action. So it's very forward thinking in that sense. So it takes into account what might happen should an action be taken. So,
but could I just is it possible then to say, you know, with regard to the human rights perspective, that we're not looking at the consequence of individual statements, we're looking at the consequence of not allowing individuals to express themselves? So you could argue that to argue against a particular expression might have a really negative consequence for the larger society. I mean, would that be one way of justifying, in human rights terms, but using a utilitarian argument?
That would go with the utilitarian argument, but the utilitarian would want for more specifics, I guess, what is being said, because that would determine the outcome. So you can argue for the space or ability or the platform to speak, but the utilitarian would unpack it a lot further in the sense that, well, it depends on the context, what you're trying to say, who is the serving, so on and so forth. Whereas if you take the liberal human rights approach, it's just about, you know, your intrinsic right to say whatever you want, whoever you want, regardless of what people think. So that's already a kind of divergence between how we think of rights and the utilitarian approach to ethics. As a result of this consequentialist trajectory, we can see that for the utilitarian, no action is of any intrinsic value, right? Or you can't argue it based on intrinsic value of, say, intrinsic good, things that are good for themselves, right? Because the utilitarian approach is so dependent on the consequences, and particularly maximizing pleasure and happiness for as many people as possible, appeals to intrinsic goods of certain, or intrinsic wrongs of certain acts, just does not whole scrutiny. So if you're arguing for slavery, or if you're arguing if you're arguing for or even against slavery, you cannot, there's the argument, the logic cannot fall back onto the intrinsic moral worth of persons per se, right? You must show how,
or the intrinsic evil of a particular practice.
Correct. You must show how this damages people. You must show how it damages society. You must show that it's long-term effects is not desirable because it would do more harm, it would create more suspicion in society, so on and so forth, it would yield more inequality, blah, blah, blah.
Does this come along with the kind of spirit of empiricism or scientific inquiry, that somehow one can't make these broad statements of values, that one needs to kind of like ground everything in fact?
Yes, there is that. The pioneers of these theories were very, progressive people at that time. You know, even Jeremy Bentham, you know, when people asked him about happiness, you know, he would answer pleasure. And then people would say, what kind of pleasure? He came up with this thing called the philosophic calculus, where the pleasure behind an act is to be measured by certain criteria such as intensity, you know, length of time, so on and so forth.
It's sounding suspiciously sexual.
It could be. And you can argue for licentious life based on utilitarian principles.
What's interesting is because precisely to say the greatest happiness, but happiness is such an amorphous concept, though in many ways we all feel we understand it intuitively, right? But when you start to really unpack it and you measure one person's happiness against another person's unhappiness, that maybe you need to interrogate the meaning of happiness.
Yes. The basic starting point for both of them is that it's a feeling. It's a kind of feeling. So it's not a state of mind. It is the presence of pleasure and the absence of suffering. And insofar as anything can exhibit a desire for pleasure and the disdain for suffering, it should be considered within the utilitarian calculus. Hence, Jeremy Bentham's early advocacy of animal rights. You know, he felt that, well, you know, for as long as this sentient creature is expressing a disdain for pain, we should take into account its welfare as well. And this is radical for a time when even the abolitionist movement were appealing to these metaphysical kind of intrinsic values of human worth, or the religious state would talk about the presence of the soul as the completion of man, so on and so forth, right? So in that sense, you're right, it's more empirical in that it appeals to what is available for the senses. And this was behind Mill's argument for why why pleasure should be the organizing principle of any ethics. It's just something that we all want. It's clearly something that human beings exhibit a strong desire for. So why not make it central to our thinking about right and wrong? Why not choose the actions that would make that the availability of pleasure widespread as possible, right?
So I guess for somebody who comes from a religious background or with religious assumptions, this would be quite horrifying, because it does in some ways, you know, push you in the direction of licentiousness or pleasure seeking, you know, kind of apart from, because I guess for some religions it is only the pleasure of God that matters. I mean,
okay, well,
and nothing else.
Here is a footnote is very interesting. Mill would go against that line of thought, but in a more, I guess, secular form, in that he says, well, as he's explaining pleasure, he makes this distinction between the higher pleasures, higher order pleasures, and the lower order pleasures. The lower order pleasures are pleasures of appetite, pleasures that only satisfy our more, I guess, carnal, animalistic desires.
Yummy.
And the higher pleasures would be the pleasures of contemplation, the pleasures of intellect, high culture, so on and so forth. You know, so in today's terms, higher pleasure would be something like Beethoven, low pleasures would be something like Miley Cyrus. So what we have to maximize as much as possible is the capacity for these higher pleasures. That said, when I was teaching this, one of my students said, you know, what if you can appreciate sensuality, sexuality, or carnal desires in very philosophical ways, you know, like in very, like what I guess higher order erotica would try to do.
Yeah, well, this is interesting, because it also fall within this kind of Christian Manichaean binary between mind and matter, or body. The body is somehow degraded. Everything associated with the mind, thinking, blah blah blah, is of a higher order. Is there something of that kind of?
People would accuse that, but there's a greater degree of flexibility in that your argument for those pleasures would not take into account notions of sin, your notions of shame necessarily, you know. So like my student said, you know, if you can, you have a higher way of appreciating sex rather than the simple kind of matter of fact way of, you know, instant gratitude, then it would fall under this calculus.
Instant gratification, I think.
Yeah, that's what I said, no?
You said gratitude.
Well, it could be instant gratitude.
So thank you so much for having sex with me. Okay.
Well, these days, that's not too far-fetched. So it's there. You can see traces of that. But it need not be bound by the strict division. So there's that flexibility, because fundamentally, the liberals, they want to see how the individual satisfaction need not be contained to our own interests. But we can use that very principle to motivate our choices to ensure that everybody else get pleasures as well.
So this distinction that Mills makes, was it forced upon him by a kind of critical response to the initial formulation of the principles of utilitarianism? Or did he kind of, in the work, try to work out all the consequences, that if you start by saying, you know, the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people, that you need to somehow define your terms?
I think the latter is most of the case. Although it is a break from the way Bentham measured utility, which was very, you know, calculable. Mill would emphasize something more qualitative. You know, he has this very famous saying, it's better to be a human being dissatisfied than a pig satisfied.
That's certainly kind of intuitive. I can't imagine what it would be to be a happy pig. But
he's aiming for not just a simple gratification of our desires, but something deeper, something that would invite more appreciation.
We're coming to the end of part one. So up next will be more on the question of utilitarianism and the two men who founded, in some sense, the theory of, or the philosophical foundations for a theory of utilitarianism, Jeremy Bentham and
John Stuart Mill.
You've been listening to Ahmad Fuad Rahman. I'm Sharad Kutin. This is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, and Night School continues with Ahmad Fuad Rahman and the question of utilitarianism.
So if you just joined us, utilitarianism is defined as the ethical philosophy that understands actions to be right or wrong solely based on their consequences. And that the only thing that matters as consequences is the amount of happiness or unhappiness. And that each person's happiness is worth the same. So I think the first section of our discussion was good in explaining and highlighting the principles, the basis of the principles. Perhaps I can give certain examples to illustrate how utilitarian ethics would operate in the real world. The typical example is the example of charity, right? Say you have 20 ringgit and you could buy a really cool pair of shoes, or you could give it to the poor people, right? If you apply the utilitarian principle, the money would go to the poor people instead of your own gratification for the shoes, right? So that would be one way, one demonstration of how the utilitarian principle works, in that as you're making choices, you're not just thinking of yourself, you are maximizing the happiness of as many people as possible.
Okay, yeah. So you could use an example that might lead you to some odd consequences if you use that principle, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
I think very famous to you, the idea would be, do we sacrifice one person? Do we take the life of one person in order to save 20 formulations of that sort, right? I mean, why is it that utilitarianism gets caught in that bind sometimes?
Okay, just some background on your example. That's the famous ticking bomb thought experiment, right? Where and this was somehow very popular in the US when I was teaching it, because there was a lot of debate about the necessity of torture for terror suspects. And the utilitarian position, I think a bit unfairly in my opinion, but not completely inaccurately, has been associated with arguments for torture. The idea being that, you know, there's a ticking bomb waiting to explode somewhere, and you have a suspect who has information about the ticking bomb, and his only interest is to see the ticking bomb explode. The right thing to do, according to the utilitarian principle, is to torture that person, get information as soon as possible, and save more people than you otherwise would say if you didn't torture him, right? And this is a good contrast with the human rights approach, which sees torture as wrong, unconditionally and without without any exception, right? So why does it get stuck in these conundrums? Part of the strength, and here is the weakness, again, as I mentioned before, is the fact that it does not rely on any claims of intrinsic value. And when that is the case, then it's very flexible, right? Because every action is to be evaluated solely based on the extent to which it promotes the greatest amount of happiness. So there's nothing is out of bounds, right? So a lot of heinous things can be justified, according to the utilitarian principle, for as long as it promotes the greatest amount of happiness for the greatest amount of people, right? So in that sense, it gets stuck in these conundrums. But what advocates of the utilitarian position would say is that it's more realistic, right? There's nothing, when you think about it, there's really nothing that's intrinsic of worth. Everything has a consequence. Right. We lie to ourselves when we think that our ethical principles does not yield any consequences. You know, even human rights, for as much metaphysics as it assumes, is upheld for consequences. The consequences might not be desirable for everybody, but there are consequences there. It's just that it's not included in the logic. So that's one of the constant appeals of utilitarians, in that, look, if you consider options we have, utilitarianism, because it's based on pleasure, very simple, very straightforward, and because it takes into account as many people as possible, so it doesn't get trapped in a solipsistic frame, then it's desirable. Neither Bentham or Mill are crude majoritarians. They don't think that the highest amount of people acquiescing to certain pleasure would make that decision desirable. Fundamentally, what they want is a net balance of pleasure, unhappiness, and the whatever other risks there might be in a decision making. So, you know, you can't just give free cigarettes because it would maximize the pleasure of the majority of the people, because you have to take into consideration the amount of unhappiness that the same action would lead to as well. So the decision behind, say, at the policy level, for example, would be to balance the two in very, very detailed ways. So, yeah.
Okay, so we had that decision about that example of, you know, killing somebody in order to save others. Now, what if you, and the violation of somebody's right to life might or might not, depending on how you look at it, outweigh the rights of others to live, right? What about questions of, say, criminality? So, for instance, can the majority, you have a playground, there's a rich kid with an ice cream cone, there are four poor kids with no ice cream. Can they rob the rich kid of the ice cream, share it among themselves, and maybe even give a little bit back to the rich kid? You know, is that something, would they say, well, no, there's a problem in this because you have to be engaged in first the act of alienating the ice cream from the rich kid?
I think some form of redistribution will happen when you take into account utilitarian principles. The word rob might not be the best way to describe that process.
But it is taking candy from a child.
But... you know, if you can argue about the virtue of sharing, the virtue of relinquishing your pleasures for others, which utilitarians do, then that's fair game, right? Now, should those four kids violently seize it from that rich kid? The answer probably would be no, because you can say that you know, there are ways around that, right? You can say that ultimately, that kind of actions is a slippery slope for greater suspicions among the kids in the playground. There's greater divisions, and therefore the pleasure received from the ice cream is minuscule compared to the larger mood of hostility that's bred in the playground, right? So you can because, and utilitarianism invites this because it's all about consequences. So the thought process is really just about that. And you can argue, I think, convincingly that while sharing and maximizing the pleasures of all the kids in the playground is called for, robbing and violent seizures of the ice cream need not take place.
So you had Jeremy Bentham, who's the teacher, and then you had John Stuart Mill, who's the student. Was Mill's work then a development of Bentham's? I mean, in what ways did he take it further, or did he ever come into conflict with his teacher?
There was no emphasis or clear demarcation of the lower higher pleasures in Bentham, because Bentham you had the felicity calculus, but they were both humanitarians of their time, you know, in many ways, and they saw their philosophy as complementing their activism. So in fact, Jeremy Bentham has his remains displayed in a museum in Britain. I can't remember this, listeners, you might want to Google this, but the image is very easily available. Because he felt that would be a good reminder to the subsequent generations of Britons of his ideas. And that would yield the greater amount of happiness to subsequent generations than, say, if his body was just to be cremated or to be buried.
So his rotting corpse is on display.
It's on display, yeah. Well, but it's, you know, injected with great dosages of formaldehyde, probably. But it's there, you know, and if you want a visual accompaniment to the discussion, you might as well, you could just Google Jeremy Bentham's body, and you click on the images section in Google and you'll see it, yeah.
As you lay it out, it seems pretty straightforward. I mean, where do you go with this once you've laid out the principles?
Well, their problems. The first is that it's very impersonal, because you have to take into account some fictive idea of what everybody wants behind your actions. And this is one of the common criticisms against it, in that you just can't live it. It might sound interesting on paper or as a thought experiment, but the daily life has it that you only really know a small portion of what society is like, and when you start making assumptions about society, then it becomes problematic. And the second thing is that it's too demanding, in that it's just impossible for you to constantly take into account, you know, everybody's welfare in everything you do. Although that, the flip side of that is that the utilitarian will argue that that's one of the strengths of its appeal. And the other thing is that people question if utilitarianism is really commonsensical, you know, because for those two reasons, then it doesn't become common sense because you really can't live out the ethic in that way, you know. To which some utilitarian advocates eventually relinquish their common sense debate and say, well, to hell with common sense. There are a lot of problems with common sense too, right? So they say, okay, you say that utilitarianism is not commonsensical, then, well, it's no big deal. It's not no real harm to our theory, since there are a lot of problems with common sense. There's a lot of prejudices that aren't checked, so on and so forth. But fundamentally, you know, the idea that a policy, a decision should make as many people happy as possible is still somehow operating, even when we don't think about it, you know, because we don't think of ourselves as egoists primarily. We think of ourselves as people of empathy. We think of ourselves as people embedded in a community, so on and so forth, right? So it's already there in some raw form, right? I think what utilitarianism offers is a certain basis for which we can defend it, for which we can perhaps furnish our actions with, so on and so forth. Yeah.
Is it a philosophy or a perspective on ethics that has withstood the test of time? Is it something that's still being talked about as a productive way of thinking about, say, real life issues and policy?
One of the key utilitarians writing today is Peter Singer, and he has this book called Animal Liberation. And it's a very influential book. In fact, I know at least three people whose attitude towards the meat producing factory industry, even meat eating, has changed drastically because of the arguments in that book, largely based on the assumption that, or the proof that animals feel pain, and our dietary habits continue to inflict those pains, and it isn't sustainable naturally too, because the industry is damaging, so on and so forth. So even that basic principle of pain and pleasure can already reveal a lot of problems in society, you know. And so Peter Singer argues for decisions and actions that are more sensitive to issues like that.
What's interesting, of course, is that we're extending the community beyond humans, mm-hmm. to animals. But by the same token, well, we don't have that kind of intellectual or social or political reciprocity coming from the animal kingdom. Mm-hmm. So that, say, for instance, I might be very conscious not to hurt my cats, but my cats are quite happy to torture to death any gecko chicha that comes into my house. You know, they love the raw meat I give them. So they are sentient beings. They have feelings. But this community that we need to keep to be cognizant of when we make our decisions or when we do something, when we act, surely must also have the capacity to reciprocate, right? I mean, it is a bit odd to, you know, because you could argue that plants are sentient too. And
yes,
where do you go if you can't eat plants?
Well,
having stopped yourself from eating meat.
The arguments are a bit more, I guess, nuanced than how I presented it. I mean, they are, the intentionality is one of the key characteristics of animals that separates them from plants, you know. That said, I think one of the key things to keep in mind is that we must act within our capacities, you know. And of course, the argument can be that humans have greater capacity to think, right, that other animals can't. They have greater capacity to express their compassion that other animals can't. Therefore, we are greater capacity to exploit nature than animals.
Where did that argument come from, this capacity argument?
This capacity argument.
Per principle.
No, I'm just thinking of what a utilitarian would say. But it's included a lot in vegan claims to their position, you know, to their way of life. And therefore, we can only function within our capacities, you know. And therefore, with that choice, you know, based on our capacities to maximize the greater good while taking into account the future consequences, then the choices to not eat meat is wiser than it would be to eat meat.
Having kind of staked out a position for utilitarianism, what kind of response did you get? Was there a philosophical response that now has a specific name, as it were?
It's always contrasted with Kant's, you know, Immanuel Kant's deontology, ethics of deontology, which is ethics of duty, which believes that every action cannot contravene the universal law. So it's founded on intrinsic principles that's contrasted largely with the utilitarian approach of focusing on consequences. And the debate hasn't really left. And in many ways, it's still with us, even in the Malaysian context, you know, between rights and that cannot be violated at all. And the realization that sometimes we need to improvise as we go on. So in that sense, you know, for the past 200 years, it hasn't changed. The tug of war is between these two kinds of... Although, you know, there are ways in which you can find them compatible, you know, like you said earlier. Although it would entail some modification of each position, you know, because the rights approach would say that actually there is something that's intrinsic value, and that's your principle of utility, which is the idea that happiness is to be maximized to the greatest amount of people as possible, right? That's already an intrinsic kind of principle that that you don't negotiate, right? So even the utilitarian claims of flexibility reaches a limit. One of the key discourses where the logic of utilitarianism appears is in the horrendous effects of global capitalism to the environment, to our well-being, right? It clearly shows that it's only immiserating more and more people. It's not yielding happiness at all. And for as long as capitalism remains the case, and that seems to be one of the effects of capitalism, then the idea that we can think or we must think of something better where the welfare, welfare and pleasure of the greatest amount of people should be taken into account, you always have utilitarianism lurking in the discourse, yeah.
What I see, you know, kind of finally in the power of that idea is the fact that it led these two men principally to extend their pleasures beyond themselves. So, you know, by having that principle, not just that, you know, I seek pleasure, but it's everybody's right to seek pleasure, you have to go to the next level, and then they included women. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, from women and the human community for, you know, outward to
animals.
And yeah. and I kind of make maybe it's kind of slightly facetious earlier and glib, but really, in fact, the idea that we share the planet with, you know, and when we talk about animals, we're really not just talking about, you know, cows that we don't slaughter for steak. We're really talking about the entire ecosystem. And so this extension, and you see this happening in other contexts, like, you know, the certain notions coming out of the Catholic Church at a particular time, that the rights that the members had to somehow by force of logic be extended beyond that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and create something like
a universal community of sorts.
Yeah, yeah. And the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Mm-hmm. I mean, that comes out of taking the idea further.
Correct. So there are these overlaps, but it's a matter of emphasis. What do they emphasize? You know, inalienability or future consequences. I think one of the interesting appeals of this theory, at least based on what I gather from my students, is that it marries the practical side to our thinking about ethics and the more idealistic side, right? Idealistic being that what we do should take into account other people's welfare. But it's practical too, because it's about pleasure, right? So you're not aiming for eternal life after death. You're not aiming for some kind of state where that represents some kind of divine order, nothing like that. Or, you know, metaphysical talks about rights. You're just like, well, let's get as many people to feel as much pleasure as possible, you know, and we'll be a good person. So, yeah, it's very appealing in that sense. Yeah.
Speaking of pleasure, are the tracks that you mentioned earlier in the start of the show, the books that they wrote, are they a pleasure to read?
I would say they're very simple to read. I think utilitarianism is, I don't know, 90 pages. It's less than 100 pages. And as philosophers go, you know, Mill's not that bad. Mill's quite interesting to read. Yeah, I would say more pleasurable than a lot of others, you know. So in that sense, you might want to maximize that as your activity this weekend. You know, there are various PDFs available on Google. You can download, I'm sure. So.
Okay, so otherwise you can continue this discussion with Fuad on our Facebook page, BFM Night School, or write to us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com or tweet me at Sharad Kuttan, spell S-H-A-R-A-A-D-K-U-T-T-A-N. I spell it out because somebody over the radio wrote to us the other day about my morning show and referred to me as Gerald Kuttan. So I you know,
Gerald Kuttan?
Yeah, Kuttan.
Oh, Kuttan. Okay.
K-U-T-T-I-N, like, you know, like Vladimir Putin and Gerald. So that's how they're hearing out there. So I thought I'd better spell my name out. But anyway, so thank you so much for tuning in to Night School. You were listening to Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and myself, Sharad Kuttan, on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.